So I'm doing that whole thing like you were doing, sitting on the cushion on the floor.
Yeah.
And it's very comfy, but I can't reach the mouse
That
comfortably.
would be a problem.
That is a problem. Do I have one more big book near me? I don't. This is dumb. This is a dumb day.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. That is our catchphrase, and you are Richard Wally from Portland, Oregon.
And you're Cassie Robbins from Garden Grove, California.
I'm doing a really extreme radio voice.
Yeah, me too.
Which means I need to knock it off. We just had 4th of July.
Oh yeah, that thing did happen.
Now, 4th of July means something kind of significant to me, but it has nothing to do with our country's independence or patriotism or even fireworks for that matter. It has to do with, it is the midpoint in the summer. And it always feels like it takes forever to get from like early May to 4th of July. Like that feels like a 4-month period. And then it feels like 2 weeks and then school starts again.
Oh, so this is your, this is your scared school's going to start again phase.
Yeah. Well, not scared, but just kind of like, I just know that if you're on the downslope of summer right after the 4th, and these next few weeks just go by like crazy fast.
Yep. And then your school is going to get harder, and it's going to be, and they're going to like slave drive and whip you, and it's going to be funny.
Yeah. It'd be hilarious. By the end of the summer, I need to figure out what my thesis is, which I still haven't nailed that down, and I should already be doing, like, primary research.
Well, I mean, you watch movies, so that's kind of
I do do
you.
That. There's my research. I can write a whole thesis on going to the movies on Sunday so you don't have to sit next to people.
You should do a thesis on that.
So how was your 4th? What did you do?
I had my, Mom and my brother were in. And we, on the 4th, we actually just stayed in. Like, traffic was crazy everywhere. We started to go to the beach, but then turned around. Because there was, okay, so it's like an hour drive from our house.
Yeah.
Beaches. And there was traffic not 10 minutes away from our house to the beach. So we were like, no, not going that day. And so we just came home and we played games and had some steak and it was fun.
You didn't even, like, go to, like, an event or see big firework displays?
No, actually, the last couple of years, we've kind of avoided that. I don't know why. It's just not really, I don't know. Fireworks just don't do much for me anymore.
Because you're a communist? Never mind the fact that we buy all of our fireworks from China.
Right.
Well, that sounds fun, I guess. I mean,
yeah, I enjoy just, I like quiet, intimate gatherings.
You're a homebody.
No, you know, I like getting out. I just don't like being out in like,
gridlock traffic.
In gridlock traffic, one, and two, it's kind of a holiday where like, everybody seems to be outside, like everybody. And it's just like the worst and everybody's, I don't know. It's not a holiday I'm particularly that fond of. I think that the importance is significant. And, you know, I'm glad to be living in a country that's pretty nice in general.
Yeah, you're backpedaling on your communism.
Yeah, I'm backpedaling on communism. I don't want to get blacklisted by the McCarthyism. The new NSA McCarthyism. So.
Oh, Yeah, I don't know. It was kind of a weird year because this is the first summer that I've spent in Orange County. Most of my friend group down here are gone at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
They're either visiting family elsewhere or going to film festivals in Europe.
Well, except for one of your best friends.
I ended up calling Amanda Kowalski, who is one of my colleagues who was in, she was on a few episodes with, Brad, who's the one who's in, Europe right now. And we both were kind of like, well, I guess, like, let's find something to do. So we looked up on, I think she Yelped or something, and found a small celebration they did over at Laguna Hills, which is a part of Orange County I've never been to. And it was literally like a high school track and field area that they filled with like booths, and they had a tilt-a-whirl and a swing ride.
Mm-hmm.
And then a cover band. So it's kind of like what they did in Pocatello, but like 7 times smaller and a lot more G-rated.
Hmm.
Like, it was a lot more, like, when they say family-oriented, they
Why
don't
didn't
just,
you
like,
just go and look at Disneyland for, like, the 5 seconds that they shoot off the fireworks and then go back inside?
Oh, that's, like, more than 5 seconds. That's, like, easily 20 minutes.
Yeah, every night?
Every night, yeah. From 9:30 to about 9:50.
See, my brother's house in Chicago was like that, and you could see the Six Flags fireworks every night.
Mm-hmm.
And I got really, that's kind of what actually did me in for fireworks. I just saw them too, it was too much exposure, and I was like, it's really boring. Some flashy lights. I feel really stupid watching this now. I just wasted 20 minutes of my life.
Yeah. Well, she used to work at Disney World back in Florida, and when we were watching the fireworks, she was still just kind of carrying on the conversation we had been going up to that point. She's like, yeah, these don't mean anything to me after seeing fireworks every night from three yeah. different parts of the park.
So that makes like, sense.
All right. Yeah, fair enough. But if we don't have anything else to bring up at the top of the show, we might as well get into our movie news.
We made mention of this beforehand. But it was through HBO. But now Starz has been taking up the mantle on getting an American Gods TV show put into place. That's by author Neil Gaiman, or Gaiman, excuse me. Depending on where you're from and how you want to. His official site says Gaiman is how you're supposed to say it.
Mm.
Actually, who's going to be taking the reins of that is Brian Fuller and Michael Green. Now, Michael Green, I'm not familiar with, but Brian Fuller is the guy that did Pushing Daisies, and I believe Heroes, and is currently on Hannibal.
Yeah.
So that's actually, he's a pretty interesting showrunner, and
prolific.
To have him at, prolific as well, but to have him at a more un-G-rated kind of network and maybe have a little bit more freedom, that could be kind of interesting.
Yeah,
people, and especially on this project.
People really love the Hannibal show. I haven't started watching it yet, but I hear continually good things about it. And I hear that, you know, for a network show, it really goes there.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. I've heard my in-laws, they skip through the violence in it. But
they just hit the fast-forward button when they're eating people.
I suppose so, yeah.
Whatever happens on that show. I don't know. American Gods is a very lauded book. Even people who aren't as familiar with Neil Gaiman's comic book work and DC and Vertigo, he's kind of well-known for this one novel.
Well, he's more, at this point, he's more known as a novelist. And it's my favorite book of his.
Yeah.
When I first read it, I kept trying to make it a movie in my mind because I wanted that, but it was really hard, and a TV series actually makes more sense. But
it is kind of cinematic.
But no, there's a very cinematic sense, and there's sort of... The one thing that I remember about when they're trying to develop at HBO is he didn't want to take any of the prickly edges off of it, which at HBO doesn't seem like it'd be a problem, but there are certain scenes in the book... that have scarred me that have scared me more than a anything else has. So it's sort of interesting.
All right, we'll see how that plays. What do we know about Starz as a network at this point? I mean, they did that Spartacus show.
They've done Spartacus. I think they have like a pirate show. I think I'm probably missing something. But
yeah, I feel like there's something more obvious. Like was the Borgias theirs?
Or, I don't think so. I think the Tudors?
Those are Showtime? Yeah. I don't know.
Maybe one or the other was Starz. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. But they haven't had
as many like award winning shows. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe this will be kind of their new, like, this is our competitor against HBO. Maybe. We'll see.
Hopefully.
I mean, Brian Fuller, surely has a good track record, so.
Mm-hmm. All right, the first news story I have here is Tom Hardy is confirmed to join Leonardo DiCaprio in The Revenant, which is supposedly a new movie directed by Alejandro González Iñárritu. Who's going to be doing that Birdman movie that comes out later this year.
Yeah, it looks pretty crazy.
As well as Amaris Paros and 21 Grams and those movies.
Sure. Babel.
Yeah, I don't know. This is these are actors we like.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Hardy, you know, whether you love
it. It's a revenge western.
Revenge western.
From Iñárritu. And I don't know, to me, I was just like, when I saw that, I was like, yeah. that was my exact reaction.
But Iñárritu is not, I would not say, is really well known for, like, tough, gritty genre stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll see what Birdman is. It almost kind of looks like a comedy of sorts, a dark comedy, but his other movies are pretty kind of grim and realist and moralistic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder what this direction is going to be, what kind of, you know, I don't see him just jumping headfirst into Hollywood genre land.
No, I'm sure he has a reason, and he's kind of tying it into his general aesthetic in general. Can I add in general to that sentence one more time? Holy cow.
Please try.
Yeah. But in general, I think that it's a... No, I think that this is an interesting take, and I always like when a director, especially somebody who's already brought a lot to the table, takes on some kind of genre.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope he brings, you know, what he already brings to it, not just going into playland.
Yeah.
So, no, I'm curious. And I mean, with both of those level of actors, it should be interesting as well.
Yeah. I'm just saying I wouldn't expect, even given the subject matter, I wouldn't expect a Django. I don't think that's going to be what we get here.
That's not what I'm expecting either. I am expecting, you know, if he's taking on a revenge thriller, I do expect there to be some kind of revenge thrillerness about it.
Something, maybe some revenge in that general is thrilling.
Yes, in general.
All right, what's your other story?
My next story is also by a very famous Spanish man that I'm way into. So Guillermo del Toro has came back and besides re-announcing that they're doing Pacific Rim 2 and all of that, he announced that there is a good possible chance that they're going to be doing In the Mountains of Madness as a PG-13 now. He's kind of come back and said, you know, I really wanted that rated R for some very specific scenes in the movie, but I think it can be done as a PG-13.
Mm-hmm.
And Universal was already really excited. It was almost greenlit it. They just kind of lost how sure they were in the project at the last second.
Yeah.
And Legendary was considering and kind of mulling it over. And now that Legendary and Universal have come together, it does make sense that this would be a lot more
possible
to happen.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a double-edged sword because on one hand, we do get the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And we get to see whatever it is he was interested in doing to some extent. Although, if the movie is less than stellar, we're always going to be wondering, what was that other version that wasn't able to happen?
Right. Well, I mean, it hasn't been that long. And I mean, I think sometimes as movie people now, we're so connected into the movie business.
Yeah.
It's
almost unhealthy.
It is, because you're like, oh, it canceled, but now this, but oh, now this. You know, there's all these news articles and all this content that keeps coming at us.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's probably not as relevant, or it was more standard than we thought beforehand, just because we weren't so plugged in all the time to it.
Yeah.
So,
well, I imagine that this kind of behind the scenes, you know, studio squabbling happened all the time. I don't think that that's a new thing because of media. Just now we're getting the information beat by beat. But I don't know. Well,
there's always a possibility of him doing this, you know, the PG-13 style, and then being able to do the unrated director's cut or
that,
whatever.
So. That's what I was going to say, is that he could film it the way he wants to film it and keep stuff on the cutting room floor for the DVD.
Mm-hmm.
Because his fans are kind of collectory, fetishistic types anyway.
You're a fetishistic type.
I haven't even talked about how before we started doing this podcast, I was watching 20-minute YouTube videos about people's record collections, so... my last story... was that the last story? No. The last story is Brandon Routh, who once played Superman in Bryan Singer's Superman Returns, is going to be appearing on the CW Arrow show as the Atom, A-T-O-M, a lesser-known DC hero.
Yeah, you know, he's like a C-list. I mean, so much of a C-list that I forgot which one he was.
Isn't he basically, and the nerds can, like, kill me via internet for this, but... isn't he basically the JLA version of Ant-Man? Like, he shrinks. That's his thing, right? Correct me if I'm wrong.
But I don't know. Maybe. There is definitely... maybe I'm thinking of the wrong one.
I might be, too. So, on the record, Jabron the Drone knows nothing about the Atom.
Have this known in the public records.
We're pretty nerdy, but I guess it doesn't go that deep.
Well, I know I've read stories with him in it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember if he's the character that shrinks down and goes to this like little tiny city that exists or something, or if he's like more of a cosmic kind of entity.
Yeah, I don't remember. I think I've read stuff with him in it as well, but he's always kind of been in the background doing stuff. So Brandon Routh, I don't know if he is the best person to cast as this. I mean, you know, he has the chiseled jaw and the superhero looks, so I think he can kind of plug him in any of these kind of things. And he almost kind of has a televisual presence anyway, and maybe that's a little bit why Superman Returns didn't work. So I think on a CW show, he kind of fits in.
I guess I more or less agree.
I mean, you are an Arrow fan. You know...
No, Arrow in general, I think, is a lot of fun. It's CW at its best. I mean, all of the characters are way more beautiful than they need to be, but... but it's pretty well polished, it's pretty fun, and it's... I don't know. It's not smart at all, but you just kind of go, oh, that was fun. That was cool.
Mm-hmm.
They do shove in, but I mean, that's one thing that the show has done right, is really shoved in the extra comic booky stuff. They've done it in a way, too, that's not just like, oh, look at this in the corner.
it's not just Cameo City.
No, they've really made it like a part of the world and made it kind of built in and kind of made it part of the texture of it. And so, I mean, for them to be adding more characters, it's neither, it makes a lot of sense. He is the character, by the way, that can shrink down to varying degrees.
Ha!
To the subatomic level.
Yes!
And doing stuff with his weight and stuff. So you are correct.
That was... I don't even know what pocket of my brain that was stored away in.
The useless because I don't remember learning part of your brain.
Yeah, I don't remember actually learning that, but I somehow knew that.
I know I've read him and stuff, but I guess I was always like, oh yeah, he's in the background. But okay.
I'm more proud of that than I should be.
You wear that with pride.
I do.
We get to revoke the hear thee now.
Okay.
And you get your badge of honor restored.
Yes.
In public.
All right. Let's go ahead and get into our pet topic. It's your turn.
It is my turn.
And the last few episodes, I think we've been getting a little highfalutin, mm-hmm. if you will, or a little blowhardy. I said come up with something kind of fun, a little light, something where the listeners can play along at home.
Yeah. And so my exact question, what are the dumbest things that pique your interest in film?
Now, I'm interested in your question because you can take that in a lot of different directions. Mm-hmm. And I even asked, like, do you mean, like, subject matter? Do you mean, like, something in technique or what?
I left it broad on purpose to kind of see what you came up with.
Mm-hmm.
Those are some of kind of the directions I wanted to go in. In films themselves, subject matter, technique, you know. So, I mean, in general, you know, when I first thought of this, well, the easy answer for me is just genre in general.
Yeah.
Kind of piques my interest. And it's neither something that comes from this deep, interesting place in me or anything. It's just like, oh, yeah, there's going to be dragons or people mm-hmm. who stab people or spaceships or whatever. It just kind of piques my interest a little.
So is that your first official?
Well, I wouldn't say that's my official one because that's just kind of, I think that's like 80% of the population, really.
Yeah.
I even think people who are into crime and stuff like that, even though they think they're being like more serious and stuff like that, crime is a genre movie, is a genre piece.
Yeah.
Like, so it's the same concept. So you're just as dumb as the rest of us. But one specific thing from genre that always kind of gets me, and I mean, they kind of pertain to a lot of really dumb stuff in general. Monsters in general kind of pique my interest. We joked about it a lot in the last episode, but about the Predator.
Yeah, any movie would be better with a Predator in it.
Yeah, but I'm at one point, you know how a comedy has some truth in it.
Yeah.
That's not a true statement that any movie would be better, but I would probably be a little more interested in every movie if it had a Predator in it.
Titanic with a Predator?
Fuck yeah. Are you kidding me? That's the best idea ever. Like some character wandering around the Titanic and then a Predator's hunting him down while a ship's sinking? Are you kidding me? That's the stuff dreams are made out of, Cassidy.
I know. I'm glad you liked it, too. So, yeah, monsters in general. You're taking a horror writing class at the moment. You're big into horror as a genre. And a big part of that is the draw of monsters.
Monsters is a big part of that. I mean, in general, horror is just kind of a pull. I mean, I like it from realistic, gritty to dumb and flamboyant, like Universal monsters, you know, or yeah. you know, Hammer films or whatever. I like a lot. I dabble in any of it, really.
Fair enough. I always said that I would much rather watch a bad horror movie or monster movie than a mm-hmm. bad comedy.
Oh, easy, yeah. And I probably would laugh more at the
bad horror movie. Yeah, it at least serves another function, whereas bad comedy just fails completely. All right, that's a good one. My first one is kind of in line, and you could even kind of describe it as a monster of sorts. Dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Dinosaurs.
Y'all know my love for dinosaurs, yeah. So.
I remember we were, specifically, we went to Tree of Life on opening weekend in Salt Lake City, kind of an art house theater with a lot of, snowballs in the seats. And we're really far up close to the screen and everything. And so we're like getting the full Doug Trumbull crazy psychedelicness of it. And then all of a sudden, you know, that 35-minute mark or whatever it is, those two dinosaurs show up. Mm-hmm. Not even like the best film dinosaurs. Like, they kind of, kind of low-grade CGI, but it's only for one sequence. But I remember you just kind of, like, popped out of your seat a little, and you're like,
yeah.
You didn't dinosaurs, tell me, what the fuck?
Tell me I dinosaurs think I even, was going to be in this.
I am not a movie talker, and I think I literally said dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs.
Yeah, and it was a small voice, but I'm not, and it just came out. Like, I couldn't help it. Like, that was an honest movie reaction.
If I'm in an especially lazy mood and I'm trying to find something on YouTube to watch that I don't want to have to think about, I just find some dinosaur documentary from the Animal Planet from like 5 years ago. And they're like 45 minutes long and they totally do it for me. Or, you know, I'll look up how far along are they in the research to create dinosaurs out of birds. That's one of my new pet topics, is like trying to find like
Jurassic Park.
Yeah. Or how close are we to making dinosaurs? It's very important to me. So in movies, yeah, I watch a lot of dumb dinosaur movies. I really like, I don't really like, but I like watching Carnosaur, the like the Roger Corman Jurassic Park ripoff. With
it's okay, just admit it. You really enjoy Carnosaur.
I do.
Say it, Cassidy.
I do. I mean, that movie's bizarre and totally campy and totally off its rocker, but it's great.
Wasn't it like rated R too? Weren't there boobies in it?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's like. Okay. I mean, it's like a low grade Roger Corman exploitation dinosaur movie. But I like that one. A ton of dinosaur movies I watched as a kid. What was the one with like the little kid who had a bunch of pet baby dinosaurs? They made like three of those movies. Pre-Hysteria, yeah. I think it's called. Yeah,
I think you're right. Well, there was the famous Dinosaur City that we had a hard time finding.
Yeah.
That was my favorite, actually.
That movie,
because not only just dinosaurs, but dinosaurs that did karate.
Yeah, I need to try and find that. Okay, what's your next one?
Subject matter, and is there like any kind of like stories specifically that kind of just like a lot of times just a good whodunit can kind of pull me in?
It's a formula that works for you.
Yeah, not always. It can get like it's funny because I don't really like it in the mystery genre because it's like.
Which is where it's
mystery genre.
Yeah, where it's most prominent.
But when it's in something else, like another genre, I like it a lot. Like in horror movies or science fiction, kind of like the mystery. I like it when mystery is brought into those other genre pieces, I guess.
Okay. But like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy didn't like blow your mind whole.
It was okay.
I really love the way that movie looks, and I love the production, and I love the acting, and I love every individual thing about it, except for the final product.
The acting's great, the directing's great, everything. And
production
then
design is gorgeous,
like...
it's shot well, but it is kind of a slog.
Yeah. Agreed.
All right. Going into subject matters, here's a formula that works for me, and I'm a little ashamed to say this. Misunderstanding humor. Whenever there's when it can be like the dumbest romantic comedy, or it can be like a sitcom kind of episode humor where one character doesn't know what the other one's saying, and the other character doesn't know what the other one's thinking he's saying. And so there creates like this ridiculous scenario where they both are acting out according to what the other one thinks they're thinking.
Oh, so Seinfeld.
Yeah, well, there was a decent amount of that in there, even more so in Frasier. There was a lot of episodes built around that dynamic. But it plays in romantic comedies all the time. That's pretty much the entire plot of How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. And it always works for me. Like, I don't know why. Even if the movie I know is dumb and ridiculous and stupid, it just makes me laugh. And I think that's why I love candid camera shows so much.
We were talking about this, why you were so into the idea of Bad Grandpa, even though you never saw Bad Grandpa.
I didn't actually go out to see it. If it ends up on Netflix, I'll watch it. But The Sacha Baron Cohen comedies, even though I think those are kind of smart politically, but there are like even the bad ones, like Punked, or my favorite one was the one on the Sci-Fi Network, I think. What was it called? Scare Tactics. That slayed me. Like, I would just die laughing till I couldn't breathe anymore, just because of the concept that somebody doesn't know that the other thing is in on it.
Yeah, we always had planned to do one to you.
I'm so glad you didn't, because I just don't think I'd react very well. And I'd probably end up getting killed in the process trying to get away from the thing.
That's the point. What would have made it really funny, Cassidy.
What if all of a sudden, like, I go past my, like, my normal fight or flight fear into a new level of fight that I didn't, like, some primal thing I didn't even know existed inside of me, and I kill your actor.
Well, then that would be less funny and probably pretty expensive. And you'd be going to jail.
Unless I actually knew it was a prank the whole time and convinced your actor to go in on the prank and we double turned it on you. See, nice, and that's the type of formula that would just kill me in a movie. I would love it. All right. Do you have anything else? Because I have one more here.
Well, is there any, like, techniques, like, specifically in movies? Like, you know, is slowing it down and then speeding it up, is that something that does it for you? I mean, I know it's not, but but for me, one thing... What?
Ramping, as I call it in the industry.
Yeah. One thing for me that I really like is when it'll help the movie out about 1,000,000,000%, and I'll like it a little bit more, is coloring. If it has a really, like, good dynamic color to the film,
yeah,
I, for some reason, will be more in tune to it and be more like, yeah, that was good. even if it's not that good.
Yeah. If they pay some attention to the hue or the color mix of the final product.
Well, you can go back to the giallo stuff. I think Guillermo del Toro definitely steals from that a lot, and I love his stuff because of that almost.
Mm-hmm.
But I was even thinking about Trance, you know? That had an amazing colorful background, and it just, like, it intrigued me and entranced me. Gosh, I did that.
You said the thing. That can kind of go two ways for me, because I do really like a conscious color palette and people to be thinking about it in their production design. Just like in the going into the computer and mixing it around. But making sure that the costume and the backgrounds and that kind of stuff are all fitting with the palette as well. I really like that. That's one of the things I really loved about We Need to Talk About Kevin, was the use of red in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that that can also be a distraction, and I think that there's a lot of places, especially in horror films, especially in certain kinds of thrillers, there are specific color palettes that these movies tend to always drift towards. In horror, it's kind of a sickly green-yellow, or browns. Yeah, in thrillers, it's kind of a steel blue, like in the Jason Bourne movies, and I kind of get bored of that after a while. Like, it just, like, every movie starts to look the same.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's kind of an overlay thing. I mean, even in the Blade Runner-ness of all movies for the last little bit, that's kind of existed.
Yeah.
In film, in sci-fi films specifically.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think you're right, but in general, I think it can really add to a movie. And honestly, I think it's when people are very specific color oriented. The film might even be kind of dumb, but I might just be a little bit more into it because,
Well, film is a visual medium, so if they can at least get you on that level, then they've done at least 35% of the work.
Yeah.
My last one here is a technique as well, and it's needle drops, or scoring the music with source music rather than with a traditional orchestral score. Now, obviously, like in a lot of romantic comedies and a lot of comedies in general, they'll just have Top of the Pops playing in the background. That's not what I'm talking about.
When they have an industrial band or Imagine Dragons or something like that.
But... yeah, and that I'm not so into. But when it's like a Tarantino style or like a Scorsese style, where they pick specific parts of the songs that kind of underscore the emotional element of the movie, and it could be like the dumbest movie or like the most obviously poorly put together story. But if they get the right groove going with the right imagery at the right time, and I can kind of feel it, it might pull a D minus up to a D plus.
No, that can be a very... No, it's. I think it's kind of true. I think they have to be very selective, and it's not just like, oh, we've got like the newest modern music in it. Because that can be really distracting too. Like, famously for me at least, I think the Watchmen movie... mm-hmm. Misuses music like crazy. I think hated it's... Hallelujah.
Yeah, that
there
one was
really also
dumb.
When they blatantly just used the Watchmen song. I was like, this is dumb.
Oh, they all along the Watchtower. Yeah.
Yeah.
Those two were kind of thudded really bad. But I really love the use of Times Are a Changing at the opening of the movie, the opening credits. And I really loved Sound of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel during the funeral scene. I think those two needle drops work really, really well for what I'm talking about. And, you know, music in general, even in the god-awful, horrifically not good Sucker Punch, there's a few good uses of music in that movie. But yeah, no, sometimes when they get it right, like, I mean, I think there's certain directors, Quentin Tarantino, who I've already mentioned.
Well, yeah, Scorsese, that scene in Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah. Is just... Well, all of his movies have at least one or two of those scenes.
No, I agree. But for me, the one in, you know, where the music stops for a second, he comes back in, it really is captivating.
Yeah. Scorsese, through most of his movies, David Lynch, I think, does it really well. But yeah, it's kind of an easy trick on me. All right. Well, I think that is our pet topic, and we can finally get into our reviews. First, I want to review the movie Obvious Child, which I caught over the last week, an indie film. All right. Obvious Child is directed by Gillian Robespierre, and it stars the comedian actress Jenny Slate, who's really well known for... her YouTube videos, as well as she was on one season of SNL before getting kicked off the show for dropping the F-bomb on live TV. And it's kind of a story about somebody in their late 20s. She's playing a comedian in the movie. She lives in New York. She's kind of scraping by. She just has this devastating breakup with her boyfriend, and she, the type of comedian who really bears it all, she sort of almost masochistically self-deprecating. She goes on stage and just kind of lets everyone in on her life and kind of makes a joke about her. And she kind of like goes on this downward spiral after this breakup, and she meets this really nice guy in a drunken stupor, and they end up sleeping together, and she ends up getting knocked up. And the movie, that's the first third of the movie, and the rest of the movie sort of deals with her scheduling an abortion for 2 weeks later, which is going to land on Valentine's Day. But also sort of her trying to come to grips with, there's this guy and he's really nice and he doesn't deserve this in his life, but I kind of need to tell him. And what ends up happening is a romantic comedy kind of sneaks in. And it's done so subtly and so cleverly that by the end of the movie, you realize, oh, this was a romantic comedy, and it's actually a pretty good one. And it's Jenny Slate, like her comedian character, really kind of just puts it all out there, and she's very emotionally vulnerable, but also really kind of strong and funny. And given how dark the subject matter could be taken, they don't shy away from it at all. It is a, you know, quote-unquote abortion comedy. And it's funny.
Abortions. Aha.
Well, sorry. Not quite like that. But it is funny. And if I were to take away anything from the movie, is that her comedian shtick whenever she's on the stage is never all that funny. Even when, like, there's a scene when, like, quote unquote, she's bombing And then later there's a scene where she's kind of redeeming herself, and as a, you know, person outside of the movie, I'm kind of like, eh, both stage acts were about as good for me. But the dialogue, the natural dialogue between her and the other characters when they're just conversing is actually very funny and very snappy. And, I don't know if you need to run out and go see this in theaters. It's not really that kind of movie. I think it'll play just as well on DVD, but it is worth seeing. And I think it's, a nice little indie gesture.
Oh, well, I was kind of averse to, well, I mean, besides it's, it has the RC in it. It's one of those RC movies.
I don't know what that
rom-coms.
Means. Oh.
The movies that shall not be named, Cassidy. I was kind of averse to her because she plays the worst character. I mean, she's supposed to be the worst character ever, but mm-hmm. she plays the most obnoxious character ever in Parks and Rec. And
yeah, that is one of the things she's known for right now.
Yeah.
I would say check it out. It reminds me a lot of the kind of vibe, the kind of storytelling, the kind of concerns addressed in both the HBO show Girls, as well as last year's Frances Ha. It's kind of in that realm of millennial issues. Let's go ahead and get into our main review then, which is also released limited, so, you know, given what we, however we decide to review these movies, they have to be sought out a little bit. But I have a feeling like we liked Snowpiercer.
Oh, are you just going to announce it?
I'm asking you, just on a general.
Yeah, why wouldn't I?
Why wouldn't
you? Yeah, no, that I mean, that was something in the subject matter that I didn't talk about. And yeah. The stuff that's dumb, but I just end up liking it. If something's post-apocalyptic, I'll probably like it. Like, or at least I'll be drawn to it. And so I was drawn to this from the get-go because they said, first of all, it's like, it's on a train. It's a post-apocalyptic movie. But you get more than that. I would say you get quite a bit more than that. But yes, I did like it.
Okay, good. Do you want to go ahead and set it up as far as the plot?
Sure. Basically, like I said, it's a post-apocalyptic movie. Basically, the world has ended, and it's gone into this, like, frozen climate, doomsday kind of environment. But so the only people that survived were these people on a train. Mm-hmm. And so you're basically it's about these people that have been stuck at the end of the train, and they have to violently climb their way to the top to try to gain their freedom. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a, I don't know, it's sort of like a, it's definitely, you can throw in some Mad Max.
Yeah.
You can definitely throw in some, like, Terry Gilliam, like, even Brazil.
Yeah.
You can just say Brazil and throw that shit in there. And yeah. Then you could, I think you could make a lot of claims for just kind of how it's shot and kind of how it's handled to kind of talk about it in almost a, Hitchcockian sort of way.
Okay.
Just the small sets, scenes and stuff like that, and more how it's shot than its actual kind of tone and stuff like that. But, wow. At first I was kind of watching, I was like, what is this movie? Do yeah. I like it? And then what was the deciding factor as soon as Tilda Swinton comes on screen.
Yeah.
As soon as she comes on screen, I know what this movie was, and I was like, fuck yes.
Yeah.
And as it goes on, this is a movie that starts out a little kind of like, okay. And it's not that the film almost doesn't have an instant charisma, because you're in these very, you know, your main characters are these downtrodden, like, stepped upon people. And so you kind of have a hard time being like, oh, well, this is, but then as soon as it gets going, it just earns and earns and earns more of, like, me just loving and liking the film. Not to mention the deep, you know, I think that this movie, you know, I mean, outside of the, you know, the social commentary in the movie is what, it is part of what makes it so great.
Yeah.
But it also, I mean, it speaks well of the director, the writer, and I think even the people who decided to be in the film as well. Mm-hmm. I just, I can't gush enough about the movie, really.
And we should say this is the first English language film by director Bong Joon-ho, who also directed the monster movie The Host.
Which I've yet to seen, but is definitely...
on your list.
Now it's a must-see.
As well as a great whodunit mystery thriller called Memories of Murder.
Oh.
Both of which are really fantastic movies.
I should definitely see that one too, then. Huh?
Yes. And it has a multi-racial cast.
Yeah.
Because this is a Korean and American co-production. And right. European. So Chris Evans plays a lead. You're Captain America. Which... Mm-hmm. They really kind of do something very interesting with this character, and throughout the whole movie, I was kind of like, I really kind of wish this wasn't Chris Evans, because, you know, you could throw as much smudge on his face and dirt and grime and rip his jacket and make him look as poor as possible. He's still going to be gorgeous no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
But by the end of the movie, and I'm not going to spoil it, there's some character reveals where I go, wow. That really makes a huge difference given everyone's contextualization that this is, you know, Captain Boy America.
Well, also just kind of how it ends up being, how it just kind of, how the ending works and everything. No, yeah. I completely agree with you. That was one of my exact thoughts. I was like, man, but he's just sort of, you know, he's sort of weird in the context, but he sort of fits, but, you know,
yeah.
Maybe we'll see. But then
by the end,
the ending came, I was like, oh, okay.
Jamie Bell plays a small character as his little cohort, and he's a lot of fun in the movie as a good little
assistant. I thought he was a great into the movie, because he was really charismatic and really a lot of fun in the first part of the film.
Octavia Spencer playing Octavia Spencer effectively, but she does it very well. John Hurt is in the movie, and as well as the Korean actor Kang Ho Song.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. He's the one of the main actors that always works with Bong Joon-ho in some of those movies, as well as other Korean directors like Kim Joo-woon.
Okay.
He's kind of a big star over there.
I know I've seen him before.
Yeah, so. He was in I Saw the Devil and a lot of movies. And The Good, the Bad, the Weird. But yeah, this is one of, if not my favorite movie of the year. Yeah, I mean, it really just kind of blew my mind.
I honestly, there's still two movies that I still think I like more. But this movie did very much
fulfill.
It fulfilled and blew my mind, and it definitely earned everything. And yeah. I mean, there are so many just great little things in here. Like even Allison Pill, the girl from Scott Pilgrim.
Mm-hmm. There's a really great sequence with her that comes out of left field, but it's so perfect when you're there.
Well, and then he has all these like small side characters that get screen time, but share the screen so well and kind of like you really like.
It's a true ensemble piece.
It's a true ensemble, but you understand their context. It's not just like, okay, who's this guy running out from the middle of nowhere? There's this character who's kind of badass, and at first I thought he was Korean, but then I looked at him and I know he's Hispanic, and then I saw his face like really clearly. He's really badass, and he comes in some pivotal moments.
Yeah.
And then finally I was like, man, who is this guy? And I couldn't pin it until I got home, and he's totally a character from Skins. And he's like, he's part of the second like cast, and I was like, oh my gosh. And it was pretty amazing for that to happen as well.
Yeah.
And just as acting and as characters go, this film hits the mark.
Yeah.
Like completely and utterly.
Yeah, everybody registers, even if they only have a few lines in the movie. Bong Joon-ho's really good about creating a lot of different flavors in the cast. Actually, the tone of the movie, which is kind of all over the place, but sort of in a good way. Like, because it's very, very grim and dark. And, you know, if you go by the overall movie, and especially by the end of the movie, is quite bleak, actually, and kind of nihilistic. But it's also kind of funny, and it's light, and it keeps you entertained the whole time. And it really kind of revels in the cinematic violence. And it reminded me a lot of Terry Gilliam at times, a kind of manic
Well, it's kind of Dante in a lot of way. Oh, yeah. It's sort of Dante also-esque. Yeah. Like, kind of him going through the several layers of hell. And
yeah, yeah. But it also reminded me a lot of kind of a Genet film.
Oh,
and kind of the madcap, like, it almost, like, when I was watching, it's like, oh, this is the movie Genet thought he was making when he made Alien Resurrection.
This is the film he wanted to make.
Yeah, this is the movie that he thought he was making. And it's just, there is a kind of a Dante aspect of it where, you know, each individual set piece is a cart on this train as they move forward, and the entire action has to be contained within this, like, you know, 25 foot by 10 foot radius. And you would think that would be very, very difficult to kind of shoot a high octane action film in that kind of scope. And it is, but it's done really well without you really thinking about how small this world is in comparison.
Right. No, it's great. I don't. Like, the only thing that I could, like, even, like, in it, I don't even think that it's, like, really taking marks off.
Uh-huh.
Because, okay, this is one thing I thought. So, as it's going through, there's this scene where you're looking at this CGI city.
Yeah.
That's all frozen out the window. And honestly, the CGI wasn't that great.
It's not the best you will have seen in a movie.
However, it was kind of a testament to me being like, okay, the graphics in a movie are relative to the quality and quantity, you know, because the quality of the film completely, it's like, no, there's suspension of disbelief. Who gives a shit?
Yeah.
Like, really? And
you're
so
into the movie that you're not thinking about the specifics of the special effects, which I think is going to make this movie harder to market, even though it is on a limited scale.
Oh, yeah.
Because with a trailer, and, you know, granted, the trailers for this movie aren't that good. I was interested because I liked the director, and I knew kind of what the early buzz of this movie was, but...
Well, it's hard to also market because you can't give away too much.
Yeah, and we're trying really hard not to here.
Yeah.
I can tell, because once you get to the last third of the movie, a lot of presumptions you've made about these characters, about this movie, about this world... really kind of get turned upside down. And I think that could be, for a lot of directors, like M. Night Shyamalan, that could be a downfall. And every time they advance up this train, with the more and more mystery boxing they're doing, mm-hmm. but there's all these reveals of what this society looks like as they get further and further up and, you know, a little bit more affluent. You're building this promise that you have to pay off, and it would be very easy for a lesser director to completely drop the ball by the last third of the movie. But I think this ending ties everything together so well, and never goes for the easy answer.
No, I think you're right, and I think that it completely works in every minute. I mean, it's funny because, but they also what they do to kind of bring you through that, and I think this is just a storytelling technique that they use very well, is they right away they kind of reveal very slowly the world.
Yeah.
And while it doesn't instantly pull you in like some other films could by doing a big flashy whatever like first kind of scene, the overall effect is so like. You know, it makes it so that we end up just gushing.
Yeah, it accumulates as you go. Yeah, no, I highly, highly recommend this movie if you can go out and see it. Even if you have to drive a couple hours to find the city that's playing it, I think it's worth it. Because I think it's a blockbuster like you don't get made out of the Hollywood system. And no, almost... didn't get made or released.
And it's cinematic. It does warrant being seen in a theater.
Yeah.
And it's...
And it's entertaining. It's an action movie. It'll pay off on that level. But it's also, I think, has some really interesting, smart things to say about class division
and then just the economic disparity. Was like a breath of fresh air because it wasn't ramp, 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 ramp. It was really like... There was some really slow, but kind of like... very interesting moments, and it had a lot. It juggled so much, but never dropped a ball.
No, yeah, and also, you know, this is an R-rated movie, a pretty hard R, and extremely violent. And by the time you get to the end of the movie, you know, you kind of realize, I kind of came to the overall thought of, this is my issue with those Hunger Game movies. This is the movie those movies need to be and never can be.
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, since we're kind of going off, I do basically agree, but I think that the first one is much more guilty of that than the second one. I think the second one kind of does go there in several scenes. Public Executions was the one time I was like, oh, okay, this one's a lot different. This is serious. Mm-hmm. But back to, yeah, I can't stress enough how much you need, people should watch this film.
Yeah, and Tilda Swinton is amazing.
Oh my gosh, yes, I was so repulsed and captivated and thrilled and laughed, and she just...
She's like Margaret Thatcher on crack. Like,
she has won this year, for me, she's in two, like... Of the movies I've really enjoyed, because like I said, there's two other films on top of
this. Oh, yeah, and her two movies she's been in this year with John Hurt that have a lot to do with climate change. Isn't that weird?
Well, and that are absolutely fantastic.
That because are both
those
amazing.
Are the other two films that I have a hard time saying that this film is better than. And I think that's, I don't know.
It's, Only Lovers yeah, Left it's, Alive is a movie we're talking about, BTS.
Yeah, Only Lover Left Alive and Under the Skin.
Mm-hmm. This is a movie that if it's going to have any kind of big cinematic life in theater, it's going to be because of word of mouth. So, you know, we're doing our part and pay it forward when you see it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's go ahead and get into our Netflix homework, which you assigned me last week. A Fantastic Fear of Everything is a British film starring Simon Pegg, directed by Crispin Mills and Chris Hopewell. Written by Crispin Mills, the first thing they've ever done, and you can kind of tell. Simon Pegg plays a writer named Jack who's locked away in his apartment, and he's trying to write a true crime story about a history of serial killers, and starts to spook himself with the subject matter, and he starts to become paranoid of everything around him, and having these strange hallucinations, and kind of getting himself into more trouble. And real dangerous situations by being afraid of fake dangerous situations in his mind. What did you think of this movie?
So it's funny because when you brought up Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy,
mm-hmm.
I kind of felt the same way about this film. I mean, it's completely different, don't get me wrong. But I actually think that the story, the subject matter is kind of interesting. I think the acting's fairly decent. I mean, it's not as good as that film, but everything about the film, there's
individually.
Not a lot. Individually is pretty good. It's the bring together, and it's just when it's all brought together, it's not very good. And I don't know if it's pacing or if it's just. Because, I mean, there is a consistent look to the film,
mm-hmm.
But tonally, maybe it's off. Maybe it's pacing and tone. I'm not sure. But they do a lot of things that I really like. I think that the color pattern is really interesting. I think the score is pretty decent. I think that, I think the subject matter is interesting. I just, it just doesn't come together. And as a comedy, I don't think it's very funny.
That was, I think, the major issue of the movie. The major cinematic sin of this movie is it's a comedy that's trying really, really hard to be funny and really, really never funny.
Mm-hmm.
It's a dark comedy, obviously, and it kind of goes there in some ways, but it's not... I don't know. It's like... It's like somebody playing the sheet music but hitting all the notes wrong.
Well, it's kind of, yeah, I mean, that's the thing is because there is a lot of right about this movie. And as a first-time film, I really actually would be somewhat interested in something else they would do. Mm. But I would definitely tell them not to make a comedy.
Yeah, I don't even know if that's necessarily the issue. I mean, I think the screenplay is a big issue.
Okay.
Because it's not very good. And it kind of, the way the story is constructed, it's very episodic. And it kind of feels like it's making itself up as it goes.
Okay.
And it never really leads to anywhere dramatically interesting. it plays the same tricks over and over again as far as you think this is happening, but oh, it's out of the corner of his eye, or oh, it was just a dream, or whatever. That gets old really fast. Simon Pegg's trying so hard to make up for the bad material that he comes off as kind of annoying and manic. Hmm. And, you know, you could tell he's doing his best to do like a Bruce Campbell Evil Dead kind of thing, and it's just not happening. And, yeah, I don't know. The movie's not really saying anything. It's not really about anything. It's, at the end, they throw in a bit of animation that just kind of feels like a last-ditch effort to be entertaining. I don't know. I felt like this was pretty bad. I don't think that it's unwatchable, but you just sit there scratching your chin saying, why isn't this taking off? Why isn't this left the ground?
Well, and I think the things that we've said is why it didn't.
Yeah.
However, it just doesn't do that, and that's the problem in general. But again, I think that there are a lot of things in the film to be like lauded and kind of be like, oh, this was sort of interesting, including, you know, to me, the actual animation thing was sort of fun. It was actually, I was kind of more into that than I was into a lot of the other
the film. Movie. Yeah, like if the movie had been done in this style, and maybe to like a PG-13 and put it on, you know, Focus Features Box Trolls kind of thing, like then we might have a movie. But as of now, it just kind of feels.
That's the whole movie to me, though, is like the bits and pieces are good.
Yeah.
But when you bring it all together, it's not really a sound movie.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I personally think that this has a lot going for it. Mm-hmm. I just think that it needs to be to have somebody like Simon Pegg in it brings a lot of attention. And so maybe that was part of the problem. I'm not sure.
I don't think the problem's his problem. I mean, I also vibe.
No. I'm just saying as an attention getter. Because with Simon Pegg, you also want a certain sort of level. Like even some of his other films that are not as good as his Edgar Wright films or aren't mm-hmm. as good, because there are things that haven't worked. He's usually pretty decent in them. And so you're expecting a certain kind of level. And I think in some ways you are getting that level, but it's aesthetically, I think there's a great style. I think that I think some of the dialogue bits are pretty decent.
Hmm.
But it fails more in pacing and in storytelling.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
And again, the big no-no is that it's a comedy and it's not funny.
Yeah, mostly not funny.
I actually thought a lot about, I mean, I think it works better, but I don't think that it's that much better as Death to Smoochie.
Yeah. It kind of had that same sort of, like, failure. Both mm-hmm. movies sort of fail in the same way. I would say on the positive side of this sort of genre, what it's attempting to accomplish is it reminded me a lot of the tone of Throw Mama from the Train.
Mm.
Okay. But I think that movie really does that well.
Sure.
Whereas this movie just doesn't. I not a whole lot to say about it. If you really like Simon Pegg and you have to see everything he was ever in, then you can watch this movie. I don't really see much other draw than that.
No, not really. I actually find it more interesting as kind of a review to kind of see.
Yeah.
Like kind of it stand up against other stuff. But as just kind of, I guess, recommending it, I wouldn't.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
I feel bad. Well, I don't feel bad, but I do, because I think that there are some very, again, I think that there are, they are these two, you know, young, I'm putting that in quotation because, you know, I don't know how old they are really.
But as far as their careers go, young.
Yeah, as a young career, I think that they are doing a lot of things right. I think they just haven't completely figured out what those things are that
they want to be doing. What I meant earlier on that you could really tell this is our first movie is it feels like a movie that's full of their fetishes. Mm-hmm. It's full of scenes they would love to direct. It's filled with imagery they want to see. It's they're fulfilling their own wish with this movie. And I feel like that's all it really is. And it comes off as a little self-indulgent because of that.
Completely agreed. That is a good way to kind of pin it down, and that's the problem with it.
Yeah.
But I would actually, I guess, what these guys need is strong screenplay.
Yeah.
Something that they can play off of.
Yeah.
And
a really good producer.
And somebody to keep them on track to kind of, and that's, I mean, that's just, I think that's necessary for a lot of people in general.
Yeah, so. True. So, that's the episode. And next week, I'm going to have you watch the film Five Easy Pieces, starring Jack Nicholson from the 70s.
One of his few 70s movies that I haven't seen.
Yeah. And I'll be interested to hear what you have to say about that. And if anybody has anything they want to contribute to the discussion in this episode, cinematic things that are kind of dumb but work for you anyway, your thoughts on Snowpiercer or Obvious Child, you can go ahead and email us at jabberonthedrone@gmail.com or give us any kind of thoughts or criticisms. You can also find us on Facebook, facebook.com/jabberpodcast. Like us there. You can see other news stories that we don't talk about on the show, as well as comment on the ones we do. And you can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. While you're there, give us a star rating and a small one-sentence review. It helps people find the show. And you can find our regular RSS feed and our archives at jabberonthedrone.podbean.com. You can also find my movie reviews that I write weekly for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can see some of the articles that I've written for the Seattle-based website, The MacGuffin, at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. You can read Richard's writings that he does every once in a while at his blog, rdwally.weebly.com. Can we expect anything there soon?
I will neither promise nor... right now, I'm kind of in a transitional phase, so...
It's there.
It's there, and I'm learning, and I'm trying to get better, essentially where I'm at, so...
You can check out Brad and Amanda's podcast they do over at Quarter Life Crisis, quartercrisis.podbean.com. And another colleague of mine just released his album with his band, The Pillow Dragon. The album's title is Teen Witch, and you can find it and stream the entire thing, actually, at pillowdragon.com. And we will talk to you next week.
Talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.